My favorite statistic I like to point out is you are fully synthetic. 50% of the nitrogen atoms in your body were put there by a chemical engineer. Regardless of what food you eat or where you live, most of the atoms in your body came from the chemicals industry. The creation of synthetic fertilizers is responsible for why 90% of people on Earth are alive today. 9 out of your 10 friends wouldn't even be alive without the chemicals industry. Your entire life broadly stems from just 3 molecules: ethylene, propylene, and benzene. Everything you wear, everything you buy, you can source from natural gas, coal, or oil.
So a lot of people say, oh, chemicals cause cancer. But you know where all those chemicals come from? Those 3 molecules that Sean just mentioned. Every piece of construction, fiberboard, insulation, that started off as a chemical. Same with your clothes. It all started off as a chemical. Before it was, you know, more natural resources, but now it's completely synthetic. What Soligen's trying to say is, well, what if natural resources and natural products could now, with our technology, be as competitive as these synthetic things and at the right price? All of a sudden, you look at how big that opportunity is, and you can't unsee that. And the way we did that was by introducing this concept of biology into chemical engineering. So how do you actually make that system more efficient, more elegant as an output? And that was by marrying the biology piece of the world. I'm sure you've heard of synthetic biology and things of that nature. Taking the best of biology and then taking the best of chemical engineering and basically saying, we want to create something that has better yield than anything in the market. And that's, I think, what we've done so far.
Welcome to The Peel, where we explore the world's greatest startup stories. I'm your host, Turner Novak, founder of Nana Capital, the venture capital firm with the smallest carbon footprint. I'm very excited to share this conversation with Gaurab Chakrabarty and Sean Hunt, the co-founders and CEO and CTO of Solugen. They started the company in 2016 with a mission of replacing chemicals with plant-based substitutes. Today, they're doing 9 figures in revenue and upending the chemicals industry with a low-cost manufacturing strategy and a focus on the customer experience, all with a negative carbon footprint. Gaurab and Sean's story is wild. A chance meeting playing poker while getting their PhDs, gloriously losing a startup pitch competition at MIT, but using the $10,000 second place prize to build a homemade reactor out of PVC pipes from Home Depot, capturing 80% of the hydrogen peroxide market in Dallas, Texas within a few months, launching, scaling, and selling a 7-figure cleaning wipes brand just to prove demand of their plant-based chemical substitutes, building a factory on top of an exploded wax distillery in Houston, and now they're building more of these small modular factories that convert CO2 into chemicals, provide a better product, and sell at a lower price point than incumbents. There are also tons of lessons for other founders throughout our conversation. Solugen succeeded where the prior generation of clean tech startups failed, by first attacking urgent customer problems and then working backwards to solve them with new technology. We'll talk about their creative approach to marketing, why logistics and the supply chain are among the biggest problems in chemicals, the 1-week work trials they use to hire their first 30 employees, and how they've always stayed disciplined while thinking big by piecing together small, cash-efficient phases of the business to get there. Our conversation gives an inside look at the chemicals industry that touches 25% of GDP and every aspect of our daily lives. It's also a masterclass in how to compete and scale a startup in a non-sexy industry. A quick shout out to Seth Bannon at 50 Years, who led Solugen's seed round and introduced us, and to Ian Roundtree at Cantos, also in a Solugen seed investors, for helping come up with questions and topics for the episode. Thank you, Gaurab and Sean, for sitting down to chat. Without further ado, let's jump in after a quick word from SecureFrame. Longtime listeners are already familiar with SecureFrame, the automated compliance platform built by security experts. Thousands of your favorite startups, like Angels, Coda, and Ramp, are using SecureFrame to get, stay, and automate their compliance with security and privacy frameworks like SOC 2, ISO 27001, HIPAA, GDPR, and more. If you've ever tried getting compliant in any of these, you know just how unreasonably hard and time-consuming it is. SecureFrame streamlines your compliance, which saves you time to focus on growing your business. I'm an investor in SecureFrame, and I recommend it to every founder I meet. Join hundreds of other listeners of the show. Click the link in the show notes to get started on a demo with SecureFrame's in-house team of compliance experts and former auditors. Thank you, SecureFrame, for your continued support. And now, it's Dr. Gaurab and Sean at Solugen. Sean, Gaurab, how's it going?
Excellent. Good to see you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, and thanks for coming on. I'm really excited. I guess just to really dive right in, assuming the audience knows nothing about Solugen or what you do, can you give us a super high level and then we can start going a little bit deeper?
This is a great question because we've answered it in so many different ways in the past. The way that I start it now is Solugen is replacing petroleum-based products with plant-derived substitutes. And we're not sacrificing affordability or performance. That's a big deal because most products and almost 90% of products that you interact with are made from petroleum. The thing that allows us to be able to replace the petroleum products is the way that we build our plants. They're smaller, decentralized than traditional massive plants because of our technology, because of the marriage of biology and traditional chemical engineering.
Why is the chemical industry interesting? Or how big is it? How does it work?
I like to, try to make things somewhat relatable. I think one of the hallmarks of the chemicals industry is that it's just not really relatable. It's just this thing. And I think it's easy to kind of live your life being like, you know what? I don't interface with the chemicals industry. The chemicals industry doesn't affect me. You know, I'm not complicit in it, so to speak, right? One of my favorite statistics I like to point out is you are fully synthetic from the chemicals industry. I think 50% of the nitrogen atoms in your body were put there by a chemical engineer. And kind of regardless of what food you eat or where you live, most of the atoms in your body came from the chemicals industry. And the specific part of the chemicals industry I'm talking about in this specific example is fertilizers. I think the creation of synthetic fertilizers is responsible for why 90% of people on Earth are alive today. 9 out of your 10 friends wouldn't even be alive without the chemicals industry.
From a GDP perspective, it's 1/4 of total GDP is just the chemicals industry. So that's a $5 trillion industry, and it's responsible for making every single product, like a pen, made from the chemicals industry.
If I get very specific on your entire life, broadly stems from just 3 molecules, ethylene, propylene, and benzene. Just 3 molecules, everything you wear, everything you buy, it's all ethylene, propylene, and benzene. And those 3 molecules you can source from natural gas, coal, or oil.
So a lot of people say, oh, chemicals cause cancer. There are definitely a list of chemicals that cause cancer. But you know where all those chemicals come from? Those 3 molecules that Sean just mentioned. That's it. So the whole crux of the chemicals fear is coming from these 3 molecules. And Solugen's whole mission is to figure out how to replace that in a more sustainable way.
And why has no one done that? Or why did the industry evolve to the point where we're using coal, natural gas, and oil?
That's a deeper question that Gorb and I love to nerd. We love to nerd out on this one. Because I think right now, when you look at the chemicals industry, you're like, oh, wow, it's a bunch of 50-year-old plants and this big pool of depreciated assets with this exceptionally low cost basis. And so even if there are better alternatives out there, none of those better alternatives will have the price economics to compete just because of this incumbency bias. At a certain point, petrochemicals was a startup. Petrochemistry was a startup in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And one of my favorite examples is the hula hoop. One of the most popular plastics in the entire world right now is polyethylene, high-density polyethylene. So milk jugs are made of high-density polyethylene. It goes into clothing for fibers and stuff. So clothing and milk jugs are compositionally the same. When this molecule was invented in 1954, there was no market for it. And so the company invented the hula hoop and went to market with the hula hoop. It was just wild to me. And so the global market for high-density polyethylene, which is literally everywhere right now, was the hula hoop in 1956.
When you kind of think through it, it probably enabled a lot of modern manufacturing.
100%. Clothes, right? Every piece of construction, fiberboard, insulation, that started off as a chemical. Same with your clothes. It all started off as a chemical. Before it was, more natural resources. But now it's completely synthetic. What Solugen's trying to say is what if natural resources and natural products could now, with our technology, be as competitive as these synthetic things and at the right price? All of a sudden, you look at how big that opportunity is and you can't unsee that. It's impossible.
Mm. We're talking about using coal, natural gas, and oil. It's all around us. I don't really think of those as being safe. Is the current kind of chemical, industry or, society, is it healthy for us? Is it poisoning us? Is it neutral? How do you guys kind of square all that up?
I'll just try to relate to a recent example. So I think in September 2022, Formosa Plastics in St. James Parish, Louisiana, had their permit rejected by a Louisiana state judge, purely citing environmental justice. So imagine you're in a red state. This isn't a federal judge. This is a state judge just citing environmental justice as the problem in St. James Parish, Louisiana. So this is on the Gulf Coast. Really, the challenge of the chemicals industry, it just comes down to 2 things. It's yield and throughput. And on the yield piece, chemical engineers like myself are actually really bad at converting feedstock into product. It's hard. The ideal chemical plant is 1 pound of feedstock to 1 pound of product. Well, the way the whole chemicals industry works is 1 pound of feedstock goes to like maybe 0.6 pounds of product and 0.4 pounds of various other things. Some of them are air emissions, some of them are wastewater emissions, some of them are called co-products, a very judicial term. Let's call them co-products, right? We intended to make these things. And then it's like, okay, well, we got this stream of co-products. How do we go find a home for it? And the chemicals industry is essentially built on this really intricate network of different companies and different parts of the value chain, all finding homes for these different co-product streams.
The margin of this industry is so tight. Because your yield is so poor, you have to be able to sell every single piece of product that comes out, or else you'll not make money. So you're looking at an industry that traditionally best-in-class companies, and these are like specialty chemical-like companies, gross margin is 20%. So it's not terribly great because of all the downstream separations that you have to do for these products. And that's an opportunity for us. Mm-hmm. What are the ways that we can actually make that margin big is by increasing the yield. Right? That's really the only way to do it.
So how do you increase the yield? And maybe can you explain what that means for somebody who's never heard this before?
If you just had general manufacturing experience, you've got a pound of feedstock. And if you had 100% yield, you could make a pound of product. So every pound of feedstock goes to a pound of product. If you have low yield, then it's less than that. 1 pound of feedstock, 20% yield is 1 pound of feedstock to 0.2 pounds of product. And then you have all this waste stream that you have to dispose of. And you have less product to sell. And so like for every pound of product, you have to buy 5 times the amount of feedstock. So now your cost basis is really high. And so the name of the game in the chemicals industry is yield. And it's always been yield.
You said chemical engineers suck at yield.
Well, that's where solution comes in, right? I think where solution comes in is the industry has gotten super comfortable with 20% yield, right? Because they can make money on it. They've already deployed the CapEx. The question now becomes, what are their incentives to actually make more money? It's going to be a huge CapEx R&D investment. So no one really does it. But then solution came in and said, hey, well, what if we actually change that yield from 20% to above 90%? And the way we did that was by introducing this concept of biology into chemical engineering. So how do you actually make that system more efficient, more elegant as an output? And that was by marrying the biology piece of the world. I'm sure you've heard of synthetic biology and things of that nature. Taking the best of biology and then taking the best of chemical engineering and basically saying, we want to create something that has better yield than anything in the market. And that's, I think, what we've done so far.
Why did nobody come up with it? Is it simply like you've got the fixed cost structure and it's like too expensive to kind of retrofit? Or
I'll be honest, I'm very much guilty in why this hasn't happened sooner. So like my background is very traditional petrochemistry. If I rattle off a couple terms, methane steam reforming, Fischer tropes, things, that probably doesn't mean much, but that's really what makes the world, right? And so like the way you can think about it is that pound of feedstock coming in, my whole background is let's smash that feedstock with a hammer. Let's put it under heat. Let's put it under pressure. And that molecule breaks apart. It makes all these co-products and these waste streams. That's the state of the art of the technology. So my background is something called heterogeneous catalysis. It's a mouthful. If you're familiar with the popular phrase like catalyze change, my background is in actual catalysis. When Gaurav and I started talking about this, Gaurav was doing his PhD in actually cancer biology. My PhD is in more traditional heterogeneous catalysis. You know, Gore was like, you should think about enzymes. And I'm like, well, everybody in my industry is aware of enzymes, but enzymes are always too expensive. They're too fragile. Like you look at these things and they fall apart, right? The beauty of enzymes is that they can do chemistry, perfect yield at room temperature in water. It is insane. Like I do chemistry at 800 degrees, right? And at 800 degrees with very bad yields, and these enzymes can do it at room temperature with perfect yields. But the only problem is that they're expensive.
So I think the timing was one of the reasons why no one else did it. People did try a version of this concept a while ago. The cost wasn't there. But now we were able to do it in a cost-efficient manner. But on top of that, there's a lot of nuanced learnings that we uncovered when you marry these two principles. You don't anticipate some of the problems that come. And so people gave up because they couldn't solve those critical problems. It's like batteries, right? A lot of people attacked batteries, but there was some practical consideration of how you marry that technology together. But then a few companies were able to do it. And then that became the whole entire premise of the industry. It's the same idea here. A lot of people have looked at it, were able to unblock a lot of the big problems, or at least solve a lot of those big problems that I think now is allowing us to scale. And I do anticipate a lot of companies are going to be trying to do something similar very soon.
And to get some definitions down, feedstock, What is that for someone who's never heard that word before? I think of like feeding horses or something.
Feedstock is whatever your plant uses to make things. So like if you're like really upstream, your feedstock could be oil, it could be natural gas, it could be coal. If you're a downstream chemicals company, your feedstock could be ethylene, it could be propylene, it could be benzene.
Which are created from the coal or natural gas or oil.
Yeah. So like Exxon, Shell, Chevron, they're converting coal, nat gas, and oil into propylene, ethylene, and benzene. And then like Dow, BASF are taking ethylene, propylene, and benzene and making
like iPhone glass or something.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, I think I got a C in biology in high school. Yeah. What is an enzyme when you talk about using enzymes to do this?
It's protein powder. Like it actually is identical to like the protein powder that you would like buy if you're trying to like do bodybuilding. But these proteins are folded in a way that you mix them with whatever feedstock you're using and they convert them into product in water at room temperature with perfect yields. Let's just say you're trying to convert a feedstock into a product that sells for, I don't know, call it $2 a pound. You're trying to sell a product for $2 a pound. Historically, if you have an enzyme that makes 1 pound of product for every pound of enzyme and your enzyme costs you $1,000 per pound, already I have to pay $1,000 in costs for every pound of product and I'm selling it for $2. But my enzyme costs $1,000 a pound. You can't make money doing that. And so like that was sort of the world that I lived in where I was like, okay, yeah, of course enzymes could do this chemistry, just not economically. They could do it technically incredibly, just not economically. Well, now 2018 Nobel Prize went to Francis Arnold for directed evolution of enzymes. I'll give you a real Solugen example. We have an enzyme that started. The wild type made a pound of product for every pound of enzyme. That enzyme can now do over 60,000 pounds of product for every pound of enzyme. And so if you take that $1,000 pound cost base of the enzyme, divide by 60,000, it's like, whoa, now you have some economics behind this thing. Not only do you have this sustainability benefit, this yield, room temperature, and water, you now have the cost component to it. You have the full techno-economics to actually bring enzymes into the chemicals industry and make an impact.
So you went from paying $1,000 for a pound to sell an output of a pound for $2. So doesn't make any sense to even try doing that, making a business around it, to then being able to buy the enzymes at like a cent a pound or maybe less than that, if I'm doing the math right.
Yeah. So it essentially drops from $1,000 a pound cost contribution to like just a couple pennies a pound cost contribution.
And then you guys said something really interesting about, you know, Shell does this, someone else does this, blah, blah, blah. If you go to the Solugen website, there's like diagrams of like, here's all our different processes. It seems like you've kind of consolidated all into the same location. You're almost doing like a full stack all in one spot. So it's like faster, but cheaper because you're also saving money on logistics, not just the enzyme process. Can you kind of explain how that all works?
It starts with a customer actually. So this was an interesting insight that we had was we weren't originally thinking about being able to own that whole stack because we're like, okay, like we're a technology provider and that's, we're going to focus on this area. But once we really started learning about what the customer didn't just want a chemical. The customer wanted a chemical in some form that they could use. So for instance, some companies wanted a chemical mixed with water, right? So that they can, you know, feed it into a system or a chemical mixed with something else. They wanted a form factor that actually allowed them to use it. That's where a lot of the value was. And so because of how small we were able to build some of these plants, we had space to start putting on, you know, additional process technologies that allowed us to basically convert our product to a form that the customer really cared about. That's really hard to do across different building chemicals assets because they're so massive. You don't have like space to blend. You don't have any space to do that. But because our footprint was so small, we could add in new process technologies and new blend capabilities to service the end customer's needs. We call it baking the cake versus just the actual like ingredients for the cake. We want to give the cake, right? I want to give the full experience to my customer. And that's where we learned that we had to include a lot of that into the build out of the asset for it to be valuable.
Trying to come up with examples here to give people kind of a reference point for the chemicals industry. So I think you could actually think about the industry a lot as sort of how like the real estate industry works. These are rough numbers. I don't know how precise the statistic is. There's like 50 chemical companies with more than $10 billion a year in revenue. And there's 10,000 chemical companies with more than $100 million a year in revenue. And so like when you zoom in and you're like, well, what are these companies? What do they do? They actually operate very much like the real estate industry where like you lose the sense of who the customer is because you're focused on the asset. You're like, I have this black box. It takes this feedstock. It makes these two products. And just like in real estate, like your main metric is occupancy. The only thing that you care about when you're looking at it at this like really zoomed in level is what's my occupancy of my chemical plant, which is utilization. Is my plant on for 200 days a year? Is it on for 300 days a year? Can I get it to 330 days a year? And when you start looking at the chemicals industry through that lens, you're not really optimizing for where you are in that value chain or where those customers are downstream or what those customers really want. You're so fixated on the asset. That's sort of how it arrived in the state that it's in right now.
The impact of that is the net promoter score of the chemicals industry is worse than a utilities company, which is saying a lot. Yeah. By actually being able to build smaller assets and bolt on these blending other pieces on that same exact infrastructure, it gives us a more customer-centric view of the chemicals industry, more akin to an Amazon versus a DowDuPont, which is much more exciting for us and much more exciting for the end customer as well.
Why would someone have a bad NPS score as a chemicals company? Like, it's just, oh, you made some petroleum or whatever. Here you go. Like, isn't that pretty straightforward?
Sean, you want to tell them about the time we tried to order chemicals?
So this was sort of like, we learned it very early on in our journey because like we essentially were trying to build sort of two businesses at the same time. It's like, hey, we got to scale up our core technology, increase what are called technology readiness levels, get ready for deployment, all this, right? And at the same time, it's like, well, our goal is to operate big chemical plants. And if you operate big chemical plants, you better be really good at supply chain and distribution. You need to marry those customers. So we're like, let's start doing supply chain and distribution, blending and like building our customer base and like sampling our core chemistry into it. And so we were like, let's start trying to buy chemicals. Like that's a great way to learn how this industry works. And you call up a big chemical company and they say, great, we'll give you a tanker truck. I think it's 5,000 gallons. And it's like, you're going to get it sometime over the next 4 to 8 weeks. I mean, if you just think like, if you're the customer here, it's like, okay, I have to have a 5,000 gallon tank at the ready in a 4-hour notice to be able to receive this thing. And again, because like their whole goal is to just keep the plant on, they're going to give you the tanker truck when it makes the most sense for their own tanks.
It basically says, look at this huge tail of customers that the chemicals industry has. But the chemicals industry today is saying, we're only going to focus on the tiny percentage of customers that are so high volume that they sell out our plants. And that's where we're going to focus our customer service. This whole end part of this value chain is going to be ignored. What Solugen said was, why is that the case? Carbon-wise, this is where a significant piece of the impact is happening. And we said, if we can build in these blending distribution pieces into our asset, all of a sudden we give access to a much broader swath of customers. Rippling did this really well in the benefits area where they looked at those medium-sized businesses. They made a killing on it. But everyone, ADPs were focused on these guys. It's the same story in the chemicals market.
You claim that Solugen is like a negative carbon impact. You mentioned decarbonization. I mean, that sounds fake. Like when I hear that, I'm like, there's no way. Like, how does that work that you're negative, negative carbon impact?
Oh, yeah. No, happy to walk you through it. So it's called a life cycle assessment. It's officially ISO 14000, right? And there's all these kind of things around it. But like, if you just start very fundamentally, our feedstock today is corn. And we're making glucose from corn. And so like, if you just do the math on how much CO2 is in that glucose, if I take six carbon dioxide molecules and I make one molecule of glucose, what's that weight ratio? I think it's something like there's 1.5 pounds of CO2 in every pound of glucose. That's kind of roughly how that math works. And so you're like, okay, this is called biogenic uptake. That CO2 was in the atmosphere, then was made into corn, right? Photosynthesis, and now it's glucose, and that's Solugen's feedstock. And then what you do is you say, okay, well, there were emissions at the farm. There were emissions in transporting the corn. There were emissions in converting that corn into glucose. And when you start factoring all those things in, by the time it reaches the bioforge, instead of being 1.5 pounds of CO2 per pound of glucose, it's around, I think, like 0.7 to 0.8 pounds of CO2 per pound of glucose. Now you're at the bioforge. So this is like the chemical plant portion.
Yep.
If you're in a traditional petrochemical plant and you're using this feedstock, you're going to smash it with a hammer, right? You're going to have all these emissions. The bioforge is crazy efficient. We ran last year, I mean, at all this year, actually. I think every 40 days, we make 70-something tanker trucks. And we have a 94% average yield of feedstock to product. Amount of CO2 still left when you're doing all this carbon accounting, still in that final product. And now you're at what's called the gate. And so now you're going to the end use customers. So in our markets, in the energy sector, where we do saltwater disposal and in concrete, the final end of life of a molecule made by the bioforge, it actually ends up being sequestered in the concrete or sequestered underground. And then in markets like agriculture or industrial water treatment, where our molecules are biodegradable, then we're carbon neutral.
So it's basically just less CO2 is escaping during the production process and you're actually capturing some of it into the final product that never gets released?
Yeah, there's carbon from the atmosphere that ends up being in our molecule. So if you stop at what's called the gate, if you just stop at the bioforge in the value chain, we're sitting around like negative 0.7 pounds of CO2 per pound of product. Incumbent molecules like at the petrochemical plant, they're usually in the 2 to 4 positive pounds of CO2 per pound of product.
Because they've created it during the manufacturing process or the processing process?
They have their own supply chains that start at either oil, nat gas, or coal. And you follow through the same way with the transport and the emissions and all that. And that's kind of where the math shakes out.
I read something about you're essentially converting CO2 into high value chemicals.
The simplest way to think about it is like that. It's like we're taking CO2 from biogenic source and converting it into products. That's fundamentally it. We're also taking directly CO2, converting that to products. That's a little bit earlier in our pipeline right now. But I think that's not an unfeasible goal to go after.
Going back to the beginning of the company, you guys met playing poker. How did that come about?
Yeah, in med school, we had a weekly poker game. I was really into poker for like 6 years. I was best friends with Sean's wife, his girlfriend at the time. We were anatomy tank mate in med school. It was a lot of bonding time, I guess you could say. And then we ended up having like a small friends group where we just played poker every week. And then one week, Sean was there.
My wife and I, we were long distance for 7 years. Gorb and my wife were in Dallas and I was in Boston. Essentially, 1 week every month, I would be living in Dallas. You know, med school people always talk about really medical things. It's like, you know, it's a lot of jargon, right? Halfway through the medical program, Gorb started doing a PhD. And I was like, oh, I'm in a PhD program too. We had a lot to connect on like the science and like what it's like being a grad student. And then it turned out that we were actually researching like very similar things, but like from two totally like orthogonal fields.
It was like, I was studying hydrogen peroxide production in pancreatic cancer. Of all things. And Sean was studying hydrogen peroxide production on noble metal catalysts, which are like so different that the chances that we sat next to each other at this poker game and we're studying the same thing, the chances were low.
Even this like first conversation, it actually just directly tells you like sort of the problem with the chemicals industry. Cause like Gorb's talking about, he's like, oh yeah, these cancer cells. I mean, these things are just making peroxide in your body at like crazy rates. And it's just happening. It's not even really trying. It's just happening. They tried to get MIT to let me mix hydrogen gas with oxygen directly in a flammable solvent for the past year. My entire reaction setup is on the cusp of exploding at any point in time, right? It's like physically dangerous to even set this up.
That's kind of how we started. We realized like there is a world where if you married these two concepts intelligently, you could maybe take the best of both. And so we went to MIT and we pitched them on this idea at this thing called the MIT 100K competition. We didn't win, but I would
gloriously
say...
Lost. Gloriously lost. Gloriously.
Wait, but you gloriously lost. What is that?
Well, I would say glorious.
That's my rebrand of not winning.
Okay.
Yeah. We're just rewriting seems history
like,
here.
Seems like things went pretty well, even though you didn't win.
They gave us $10,000, right? So at the second place or whatever place we were, they gave us $10,000. And Sean and I were like, okay, we have an option in front of us. It's a fork in the road. We can either keep going and try to like make this thing happen or just like call it, right? Like, hey, this has been a good run. It's been fun. And then we said, let's just try. Let's just see if we can make this happen. And so we went to Home Depot. We bought some PVC pipes and I expressed some enzyme. Sean set up the reactor and we just made it happen. And so at that point, we were like, wow, there might be something here. The product that we were making at the time, it was peroxide mixed with some gluconic acid. And we didn't know where to actually sell this stuff. So we made a list. I still have the Excel sheet. It's this list of 100 different markets where we could sell this product, right? So it was like weird stuff like flowers, right? How do we use this product to help flowers stay fresh longer? All the way to like, you know, antiseptic packaging and semiconductor stuff. It was wild, right? We had this whole list. And the only one that we could justify with the price for the product and our access to the market was something called float spas. So float spas are these like, have you heard of isolation tanks? You just like lay in them.
Is this like cryo where you like freeze your body?
It's like it's this water solution. It's just water with a bunch of salt in it that you can float in.
It's like sensory deprivation chambers.
So it's literally like a floating spa thing. You lay in and you float.
We were as shocked as you, Turner. The whole industry. It's like it was just so hot at the time. And we went and talked to them and said, well, what do you guys use to clean the water? And they're like, oh, we use peroxide. But they pay a lot for it. They paid like, I don't know, was it $20 a gallon or something? $40 a gallon. It was a ridiculous amount. And at the time, we were at such a small scale. It was a PVC pipe. We just said, you know what? Let's take over this market. Let's be the peroxide kings of a very obscure niche market.
And this was it only in Dallas?
It was at the time, it was only in Dallas. The thing that really allowed us to take over the market was this MIT 100K pitch. It actually came online on Facebook or something. And one guy who was the head of like this Facebook group that had like 300 float spas in it, he saw it and he posted it on his group. And all of a sudden, we were getting calls. And that's when that business really took off for us.
I had a day job. Gore was in his last year of med school. And we just like rented lab space. And it was a hobby. Like, I love telling everyone, like, it really did start as a hobby. We would kind of go in early in the morning, try to get this reactor at steady state because we couldn't afford process controls. We'd go and do our things and be like, man, we pray that the reactor doesn't like overflow, right? Or whatever, which it did all the time. And then in the evening, we'd come and try to get back in a steady state. And then on weekends, we'd put the chemicals in our cars and we would drive around to the Dallas boat spas. And actually our first customers, we like poured the chemicals in there.
Full service, man.
Full service, right?
Yeah. We were full package.
And it's interesting because like, that's when we like really realized the pain point of shipping and logistics. Like, we experienced it firsthand because then we were like, well, our customers are all over the country and like we have to ship hazardous chemicals. And we were like, when we eventually went to Y Combinator a couple months later and we talked to all these cleantech 1.0 founders, like it was this common theme that like the cleantech 1.0 playbook was you just do a whole bunch of R&D and then you IPO the company to build your first mega plant. You're essentially just painting this picture that you're going to be able to like push buttons, ship 6 rail cars a day of material, even though your core competency is like benchtop R&D. And so it was like, oh, well, we're experiencing supply chain issues. That's a big pain point for us, the big pain point for our customers. Like, let's make that a core competency of Solid Agent.
You did all this with the 10K and you kind of used the 10K in your bank account and were profitable growing the 10K or like?
Yeah, so that little PVC reactor within 3 months, I would say, it was giving off about 10K a month, something like that in cash. Again, for two guys.
It's just the two of us and we have day jobs.
It was like an infinite amount of money, right? That's where we got motivated for this whole YC concept. We didn't know anything about, you know, YC or any of this stuff. And I can't remember who we talked to. We talked to someone, we were like telling them like, oh yeah, it's like, we've got a profitability mode, blah, blah, blah. Things are going really well for us. And they're like, oh, you have to apply to this thing called Y Combinator. And we looked it up, learned a little bit more about it. It seemed really cool for software companies, but they didn't really have much of a track record at the time for anything hard tech. So it was reluctant. We were pretty reluctant about it, but then we just did we got an interview offer and then we just fell in love with kind of the intensity of the people there. And we're like, maybe this could be good for us.
Yeah, I mean, I remember it like very vividly because we did a 6-minute pitch to Jessica and Jared. And I feel like this entire interview, we essentially covered in 6 minutes. Like, it was wild.
I love that intensity because like, we're coming from academic backgrounds. That's how it was for us, right? Like, we get grilled on the spot and stuff. And we loved that accountability that was created.
And then you went to YC, right? You got in. I think I actually found your application video on YouTube. I don't know if you guys will throw it in the notes of the episode if anyone wants to watch it. It's like a minute.
I think I know what you're talking about. We're basically, our whole pitch was dropping costs and increasing rates or increasing yields. I think that was the whole entire focus of what we were trying to say.
I think Sean said the same thing like 3 times in a row or something about explosions. And
explosions.
You made a joke.
Yeah, so
you made
many a joke explosions.
About it. Yep. Yeah, it was that video. So, and then I think at one point, I don't know if this was like before or during YC, you guys hit 80% market share of the float spa peroxide market or something. I mean, that's impressive, but what does that even mean?
I mean, again, 80% of 300 or something close spas, it's not huge, right? We're talking maybe like 300K or something like that. Top line a year, but that was a lot for us at the time.
The whole YC process, did you move to San Francisco and stay there just a couple of weeks during the YC portion? Like, how did YC kind of play out?
We actually relocated. We rented space from Easy Post. We took our stuff from the Dallas lab, put it in a pod shipping container, And then we relocated to San Leandro for the 3 months of Y Combinator.
And then I think I actually saw a picture of one of your like initial reactors. It was like in an office with one of those office ceilings, like the white tile things, and the reactor's like going into the roof or something. Is that even, how did you do that? Like, that just seems maybe not the safest.
Yeah, but it was also, we could do a lot of things in that lab. It was a challenge lab. They didn't really care. But actually, it was one of our main requirements for finding a place in California. We're like, we got to get taller ceilings. And I think Easy Post had like 20-foot ceilings. We were like, yes, this is it.
My friend Seth Bannon at 50 Years, who invested, also introduced us. So thanks for Seth. Is that the lab that he met you in? Because I think he said he met you in this janky lab.
That was the lab he met us in.
He's the only investor that ever, you know, met Solugen when we were in the Dallas lab days, kind of pre-Y Combinator.
I would say he was the first true investor that believed in what we were doing. He saw us from literally the beginning. It was really meaningful for us to have him along for the ride.
How did you meet him? And then how did that go, raising that first round when you mentioned earlier YC had never really done this kind of company?
So we met him through YC's internal networking thing called Bookface. So I think he shot us a note on Bookface and we just started talking, and that's when he came out to visit us. So this was right before we started YC. So we got to meet and get to know him. And then for the fundraising at YC, we were told by our partners that do not expect to raise any meaningful money. No one understands what peroxide is. Classic YC, like brutal reality check kind of stuff, right? And so we didn't have any expectations. I think we were so memorable because we actually brought the reactor to the Computer History Museum at the time.
Was that the demo day?
Yeah, during demo day, we had this reactor running in the middle of all these investors, and everyone's just looking at this thing being like, what the hell is that? Is this a safety hazard? What is this thing?
Yeah, we carried it upstairs to the Computer History Museum, and like, we had the full intention, right, to run this thing. And like, we actually did run it for the first 30 minutes, but it's got this crazy noisy air compressor. And then the event organizers were like, none of us can hear ourselves think. Like, you need to turn this thing off.
But that was the strategy, Turner, was to make it impossible for us to be ignored.
No one understands what you're doing, but at least they know that you're there.
We did the whole pitch and stuff, and people got it. I mean, just as we're talking right now, once you see how big this opportunity of chemicals and materials are, you cannot unsee it. It's like this whole Matrix thing. It's like, those are the markets I love, where you just can't unsee how much opportunity is there. And that got people really excited about what we were doing.
It's definitely pretty crazy when you think about it, that not as many people talk about this market. I mean, it's kind of hidden. It's just a part of everything, but you can't see it.
And I think that's a piece of where early days, why we were successful in raising that seed round, is we were able to really complete this story of, well, great, the chemicals industry is massive and it sounds like it sucks, but how do we fix it? And Solugen was really the only player at the time that was really going after to fix that market.
So then how much money did you guys raise? It's probably more than the 10K that you first raised.
I think we raised around $4.5 million or something.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And we were not like a software company. So it was a big, big deal because it showed that like all of a sudden, this is cool again. Clean tech might be cool again.
So what did you do with the money? That's a lot.
It's a really interesting question because we were sitting there and Sean and I were like, okay, we're going to invest and build out the next pilot plant, right? The way we like to do things, we like to think big, but like figure out what are the small little steps that we can take to get there. And he said, great, we have $4 million. What is the next phase? What's the next step? And so we said, hey, let's build a pilot plant. And then a bigger version of our PVC reactor. And we sat there thinking, it's like, man, like if we sell this for the industrial price of peroxide, it just won't really be throwing off that much cash. How do we, just like we did with the flow spas, how do we up the price of that peroxide as much as possible? And how do we solve the customer's pain point? And then our float spa customers came to us and they said, hey, like, can you guys make this in white? Can you put this like into like a white product that I can use at home? Sean and I said, this is genius. We're going to make a white because we did the math.
I would say at every stage, like we've been very disciplined on the technology scale up, and it's all driven by techno-economics. So the techno-economics sort of inform this go-to-market. And so every pilot plant is like not profitable. We essentially set this goal. We're like, we want to have a profitable pilot plant. And I think we did a 10x scale up of kind of the PVC reactor. And we were also like, oh, we can afford to have the metal reactor now. So we can fully realize chemi enzymatic manufacturing, like the first iteration of the True BioForge unlock new molecules.
This was your research you were doing of like, what can I do with this?
Exactly. This is sort of the research we're doing. We're like, finally, we can like execute on what we really want to do, which is combine enzymes with heterogeneous catalysis, do it at a 10x bigger scale. You know, if you had that 90% uptime on that pilot plant, I think in the wipes business, the theoretical max top line would be like $16 million a year is how the math shook out. We were like, okay, this is amazing. It's a pilot plant tied to this product that has like a theoretical top line of $16 million a year. That's how much we'd be able to supply. And we did customer interviews. There's some pull from our current customers to go get it. Let's try to set this up.
But we underestimated how freaking hard CPG companies are. This is like classic founder, you know, hubris or ignorance, whatever you want to call it. At the time, we were looking at it from a, hey, it solves a customer's pain point. They want this. There's clear needs for it. And I think we can make money on it. But what we didn't realize is marketing is one of the most difficult and most expensive pieces of the puzzle that neither Sean nor I were experts in. Our first, actually, Sean, do you want to tell them what our first branding was for Ode to Clean Wipe?
Yeah. I mean, it was one of these examples where like our investor base was like, we invest in you guys because we really believe in like you guys for making chemicals, changing chemicals. It should be like, you're not the founders that are going to execute on a CPG company. We're like, no, we'll show you wrong, right? In the end, they were totally correct, right? But I remember our first branding session, like we hired a branding firm, but like we sat down with them and I proposed that the brand name or the tagline should be Everybody Wipes.
Everybody wipes.
And I was promptly forever fired from the marketing department.
But what we did was we built the whole entire brand. Ode to Clean. We built a whole entire supply chain. We built a marketing function. We built our own. We were doing our own packing of the product in Houston by ourselves. So we didn't know anything. We didn't know that you could outsource a lot of this stuff. We just like said, hey, you know what? We're going to do it all. And so we launched in 2018.
No. We launched October 2017.
Oh, sorry. 2017. 20, you're right. You're right. We sold it in 2018. So basically when we launched, we sold out of our inventory. That was shocking. And it was really funny because we were like, there's no way we're going to sell anything. People aren't going to care about this. But for some reason, people got really excited by this ability to like be part of the bigger Solugen mission, not just the wipe, that it did really, really well, at least by our standards at the time. Fast forward like a few months, I was running our Facebook marketing and everything like that. And it was pretty brutal, to be frank with you. Like I was in mom groups chatting with like all these moms on Facebook. I was in every single like, you know, just everything that we could do to make sure that this brand was like getting word. I did. It was not my skill set. So we said at that point, like, hey, like we were able to prove that this thing is real. There was a strong run rate that was on that business. We got an opportunity to sell that brand and we sold it for a good chunk of money for us again at the time. But that turned into a supply contract that ended up base loading the next plant, which is exactly what we wanted from the beginning.
So the point of it was basically you're not a CPG company, but the whole purpose was create this product just to prove that you could create products with this new material science you'd kind of developed in this whole new process and prove that there's demand, prove that the product actually worked. And then get some cash. Did you make money on the wipe business? Like at the end of the day, you generated cash from it?
We generated cash. Well, mainly through the sale is where we generated the cash. But it ended up being really good for us because CleanTech 1.0, again, going back to like, well, what was before us as part of this big idea maze was a bunch of CleanTech 1.0 companies who never thought that they should ever launch a product, right? They should just focus on building the biggest technology possible. If you build it, they will come. YC really taught us the opposite, which was the customer decides what you build fundamentally.
I read something where you were, as part of the sale process, you were like running hyper-targeted ads, like at specific personas at businesses that might acquire the company.
This one, I mean, it was one of these things where we really tapped into the YC network. Like YC has some folks that are just scary good at this marketing. I forget who we were talking to that kind of like threw up this idea, but we were just like, If you're running a CPG company and you target single individuals with like your monthly ad spend, like you could create pretty scary echo chambers that are hyper targeted single individuals. And Gaurav pulled it off.
So basically, what we did, so like within, you know, 2 or 3 months, we kind of had the feeling that like, okay, CPG company, super hard. How do we convert this into a win for the supply chain contract for the business? So we said we have to get this thing bought out. Otherwise, it's just going to take forever. Like these big companies move so slowly. So we had to force their hand. So the only way we could do it is doing like super targeted LinkedIn ads. I will tell you about a creepy billboard ad I did once. So basically, we figured out where one of the executives lives for a potential acquirer. And we figured out his drive to work. And we bought every single billboard on the way to the office and on the way back to the office. So the only thing he saw was, what the hell is this thing? Like, why am I seeing this everywhere? He calls me up. And he calls me up because I had reached out to him before. He calls me up and he's like, all I see is this ode to clean thing. What is this?
And I remember having some friends text me photos. Like, I saw your billboard. Like, I didn't know SolidJet was so big. And I was like, those billboards aren't for you. Stop looking at my billboards.
So there's just a lot of weird like hacks and fun things that we were able to do early on. I think that led to a lot of our kind of the culture and ethos of the company, I would say.
The other thing was like, so in 2018, that's when we, you know, we raised our Series A. We acquired this facility that we're currently sitting in right now, Gorbis 2. It's this former exploded polyethylene wax distillery, the home of BioForge 1. And in 2018, we were like, okay, let's go back to industrials. Let's use the pilot plant and do blending and supply chain and enter energy and industrial water treatment for various chemistry market pull reasons. And having that product and being able to go into these different meetings and like put something on the table, it's like, wow. Like, cause I think we were still three people at the time. It was just Gorb and I and our first employee. And so it was like, wow, they're not an ideas company. Like they made something, right? And like, you can bring it home and like, you can, you know, give it to your kids, right? It just actually helped a lot on giving us that credibility to like really enter the industrial side.
You know, at the time you're proposing this crazy new product that they should buy, and there's probably career risk for them as an executive at like a, you know, multinational Fortune 10 company or whatever.
So the key unlock in 2018, it's this philosophy that we learned on the customer side. There's trust and fear, right? So trust is, are you a credible company? Are you able to do what you say you can do? And then there's fear is, how is my career going to be like destroyed if I work with this company? Like, is my reputation going to be hurt if this thing doesn't work? So what we did was we optimized for both. We said, let's build as much trust as we can. I think the wipes business, all the press, all the like the technical stuff helped a lot. And on the fear side, we would just basically do free field trials. We would go out to the market, and when they use the chemistry, usually people charge a lot for that. We didn't charge them anything. We said, hey, we'll cover everything. And if we mess up, we'll pay for your whole system. If we mess something up, we will pay for it all. So all of a sudden that fear amount started to decrease. The trust started to go up. And all of a sudden these customers were like, wow, these guys actually are able to execute and do what they say they're going to do. So very quickly in 2018, we started to become a brand where if you were working with SolidJet, it actually became a good thing for your career versus like a risk for your career. And that's why in 2018, we were able to skyrocket revenue. We did 10X from 2017 to 2018. Simply because we were able to unlock a lot of this trust aspect of the equation.
And I think on the trust piece side, this was also where we started leaning into the blending supply chain distribution. Because like, if you're going to trust us to do a field trial, the first thing that like you, our customer, who's like this decision maker is like, can they even deliver a tanker truck to me on time, right when I want it, right? We had just a handful of customers, but we were like, let's give them absolutely insane customer service, better than any of their other vendors, that they're just going to like, if they want an order and they want it there in 4 hours, like we're going to move heaven and earth to get it there.
I'm in my Toyota. It's like, I'm in my Camry coming to your place.
Oh, right, you're telling the tanker truck with your Camry. Yeah,
you know? Exactly.
You guys said something that you kind of skipped over. You built your factory on like an exploded wax. Like, I was going to ask about that. What is it? What's the story?
Yeah, it's kind of wild. So it was kind of right at the Series A. It was like, okay, we need to move out of we were in like this, it was a former Napa Valley Auto Parts, and our lab was carpeted, and it was really, you can't build a 10,000 ton per year chemical plant inside of this. And our singular focus was like, let's build BioForge 1.
Which is the big commercial version. So we did our Series A, and that was to help fund the big commercial version.
You know, we looked all around Houston. It was really weird because like, I was on loopnet.com, and this was, I ended up touring 60 facilities, but the place we're at right now is the first one I went to. I like sent an email in, and within 2 hours I was on site touring it. And with Gorb's dad, actually, you know, we were like, oh, this is the one, this is the one. But we partnered with the Houston Brownfield Redevelopment Program. It's this really great program where they want to take these brownfield sites that are environmentally challenged, is a phrase I'll use, and redevelop them. By doing that, they actually help you get like a Small Business Administration loan to kind of move in. And so we're on a 5-acre facility. I think when we moved in, we were 8 people at that point. We all kind of worked out of the main front conference room, but like, I think the initial mortgage, I think it's like $12,000 a month, right? You're on a 5-acre chemical plant for $12,000 a month. I think there's 11 monitoring sites. And so like at this point, we have what's called a municipal site designation. So the facility is effectively remediated.
The reason the history is so cool is because like we're in Petropolis, right? Houston, Texas is the middle of the petroleum industry. And here we are on this site of a petrochem plant that blew out all of the windows in a 5-mile radius. And we're coming in and saying, hey, we are a carbon negative chemical company that has risen from the ashes. So for us, there's like something so meaningful about the history of this place that we had this opportunity. It really helped us keep the team really motivated during hard times.
And speaking of the team, I've heard you mention something that I thought was really interesting. You did these 1-week hiring sprints. It sounds like you don't do them anymore. It sounds like you stopped at a certain point, but can you kind of explain what that is and why you did it and how it worked?
This was a recommendation that came from our YC partners. It's very difficult to scale. That's why we don't do it anymore. For our first like 10 or so employees, we would essentially ask them to like take vacation from work for a week and then sign like a 1-week consulting agreement and work with us on like a small kind of time-bound project. And it was super helpful because you're actually self-selecting to a certain portion of the population that are risk takers, right? What you're asking someone to do, most people would just say no. And so you're self-selecting. And then at the same time, you're also like, oh, do I work well with, you know, this person? How do they fit in with the rest of the team? And you're also getting, you know, 1 week of extra help. So it worked phenomenally well.
It was great because like, you can see all like aspects of the person, not just the intellectual piece of them, but also how they respond to what's seemingly a lot of change. Like even in that week, the company could change dramatically. And so they got the chance to see like what that was. Yeah. Like, it's true, right? It's just the way the world worked for us back then. And we got to see the kind of this that we thought were awesome. By the end of the week, we were like, just go home. It's not going to work out.
Oh, no.
Okay. And it's an interview as much for them because there's a whole contingent of people out there that like the idea of being at a startup.
Yeah.
But, you know, and you know, we're over a 200 person startup now, so it's a bit different, but like a sub 10 person startup is a totally different experience. And so like, there's certain people that actually perform quite well, but they're just like, yeah, this is not for me. This is too crazy.
And you were probably hiring from just local traditional chemical industry people sort of in Houston or?
Whole mix of individuals for various functions, generally acrobats though. We were looking mostly for aptitude, clock speed. Can they be an acrobat?
And then you just mentioned revenue grew 10x in 2018. I think you mentioned it was due to oil and gas contracts. It's just kind of like local customers around Houston. What were you doing for them?
Well, same kind of thing that we were doing for the Flux Bus, water, right? The product was used in the water to clean up the water. When you make oil, you actually make more water. And right now they either dispose of the water or try to figure out what to do with it. Our chemistry allowed them to clean that water up and reuse it for different applications. That was a big, for us, an environmental piece of the puzzle. Wasn't just saying no to oil and gas. It was saying, hey, how do we help oil and gas in these contexts? Because it's not going away for some time.
Yeah, you want to talk hidden environmental problems. I think it's every barrel of oil makes somewhere between 3 to 8 barrels of water.
4 to 10. 4 to 10 is
4 to 10
new
barrels of water. Yeah.
And this is contaminated?
It's contaminated. Now, interestingly enough, it has very similar water chemistry to float spas. That's
a lot of salt.
That's the connection.
A lot of salt in
the water. And so it was sort of like, okay, bigger volumes. It's an environmental challenge. It's sort of a natural kind of next step. We're in Houston, right?
Good to have close proximity to customers, especially when you're doing the hands-on.
Precisely. And like that goes back to the trust fear ratio, right? Where it's like all of a sudden you need to make sure that you're in front of the customer showing them how this stuff works.
And then I think summer of 19, you guys raised a Series B that wasn't that much bigger than the Series A.
Yeah, we didn't need that much cash at the time. But basically what it did is it allowed us to continue expanding out our first Bioforge. So Series A money helped us fund Bioforge 1, but then we wanted to do some expansion. So we basically had Series B to help do that. Simultaneously, we had an R&D program for different products and different molecules. So it helped us accelerate a lot of that. And I think Founders Fund led that round.
And then when you've mentioned this Bioforge a bunch of times, that is what you call the big plant, correct? The name of the factory?
Yeah.
And you also mentioned too, you're essentially running two businesses. Can you really quick explain that? Because that sounds super complicated. I mean, you guys have done multiple things at the same time throughout the whole history of the company. But
so if I paint kind of one vertical, so it's like R&D of new molecules using this, you know, enzymes and metals, and then you launch them on the BioForge. What the BioForge does is it sells bulk chemicals, right? So if you want tanker trucks, if you want rail cars, you can buy it from the BioForge. And then there's a vertical that's, okay, it's super customer focused, it's market facing, the blending, the distribution supply chain. The BioForge will actually sell to the blending supply chain distribution business. Like actually all of the customers from BioForge One came from blending supply chain distribution. Like effectively, like it was the sole customer of the plant and it was sold through that. But this market facing one's so critical because its North Star is delighting the customers, making them as happy as possible. And BioForge One is there with, you know, sustainability, unit cost leadership.
So fundamentally, where we were at the time, the reason we were able to scale so quickly as a company is because we did that distribution piece of the puzzle. I think a lot of people told us that was stupid, just like the wipes. They said, don't do that. You're going to be, you know, burning resources, blah, blah, blah. And we also knew that the most important thing to our customers was trust. And the only way to do that was to deliver consistency to them every single time. The product is the same quality at the right price, delivered on the right time. The super boring stuff that technical people don't like to talk about, those are the things that customers care about the most. I mean, yeah, everyone wants to say like, oh, we're sustainable and stuff. But if you're not able to deliver a sustainable solution on time, they don't have a product to sell. So at the end of the day, for us, it's all about making sure that customer happiness is the true metric for us.
So you kind of started with this selling other people's products and then have slowly started to create your own. That's essentially how it all ties together.
Precisely.
And it's also kind of a mix where our goal is to eventually make all the chemicals, right? And like when you look at it from a customer's viewpoint, they also don't want to have 20 suppliers, a supplier for each different molecule. So part of it too is like, hey, we're coming to you with this. Like, this is what the BioForge can do today. Here's our roadmap. Let's talk about partnerships. And at the same time, it's like, well, what else do you need help with sourcing? You can think about it from like a customer wallet share perspective, where it's like, what is the suite of chemicals that, you know, some of them tie into like what is on our future roadmap, but it's this suite of chemicals that complement our existing offering where we can go to that customer with the full package.
Based on everything I've gathered, the distribution and the selling other people's products, you make margin on that and you're essentially using that to reinvest in CapEx to build out a lot of your own capabilities, which...
Okay.
So smart strategy, but like you said, a little bit crazy. It's just not what people will probably tell you to do, but
you always get conflicting advice from everybody. That's sort of the nature of advice.
So we just did it and it works and we're going to keep doing it because it's like, it's a tried and true playbook for us now that we're just going to keep doing.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like you almost take just like a first principles approach of how do we distill this down to solving the problem that the customers need, making money doing it, which I guess was a controversial thing up until recently. So then when you talk about creating your own products, how do you do it? It sounds like maybe that's more Sean's domain, but like, how do you decide, oh, we're going to make CO2 concrete something or water treatment? Like, how do you decide what to do?
Gaurav's the product guy.
We're both hyper technical, where Sean is super technical is on the engineering side, where I'm more technical is like, how does this all integrate into the product piece of it? And the way we think about the product fundamentally is, again, this is going to sound boring, but it's the customer. Let's look at a single customer is not just buying one chemical or one product. They're buying a bunch. So the question is, if we look at our customer stack, what is the most common chemistry that they're buying at the highest volume that has the biggest price impact on the bottom line of the customer? That's what we go after next. So instead of saying like, what is the technology capable of doing? It's a pull from what the customer is already purchasing.
And that's because, you know, if you're buying something that has, it's a big ticket amount that impacts their profitability, it's just more likely that they'll buy it from you.
The barrier is so much lower all of a sudden. Very different approach than Cleantech 1.0. Cleantech 1.0 was all about technology first versus customer pull.
So you think that was, I was going to ask you about that. You think that was kind of the big misstep, or if you had to summarize Cleantech 1.0 failing, it was just not solving problems for the customers, maybe going more tech first than customer first?
It's tech first instead of customer first, but it is this sort of like fundamentalist first principles view of a market entry strategy. Because like, let's just take an example. I'll call it like a drop-in market. Let's say there's molecule A and it's like very unsustainable, you know, got dozen assets all around the world, fully depreciated, and the owners of those assets have fully diversified balance sheets. If you have a better process for molecule A, you need to go build a $500 million plant, and your competitors can just drop the price, actually have negative margins, sustain negative margins for years, while your brand new asset that you just got all this debt on just goes under. And so like, here on the molecule A side, it's molecule A, it's drop in. You don't have to do any product innovation. I think what's unique about Solugen is we've got Gorham and we do product innovation, right? And so it's like, because a lot of what you're trying to match is like, how do I create differentiated value in the marketplace? How do you tie to that technology roadmap where like you're delighting customers every step of the way? And every time you delight customers with a new product, it's bringing our organizational capability to deliver that next molecule even further.
And so fundamentally, when you look at it from a cost of customer or a cost or CAC basis, it's a lot cheaper for us to continue delighting one customer and expand wallet share than it is to go and try to market and get, you know, a bunch of hundreds of other customers. So for us, it's just find the right set of partners and go super deep with them.
What is interesting is you do actually see this, a similar framework to this being used by the government now of all places. So the government in Cleantech 1.0 was all focused on this thing called technology readiness levels. And now government grants, you have to tie technology readiness levels to what are called adoption readiness levels. Okay. And that adoption readiness level is really to address this whole problem of you can't just focus on the technology and go say, I'm going to go build a world scale plant and find customers later. You have to be working with those customers and qualifying in every step of the way.
And then technology readiness is basically, does it work?
Yeah.
And then you guys sort of also have a little bit of like a, I hate the word ESG, but there's like a little bit of like a, hey, we're actually like safer for society. Like there's a little bit of that component as well.
It's an important piece of the puzzle, just given what we're able to offer on the sustainability side. Mm-hmm. What I found though, is that by itself is, at least today, it's not the thing that's really getting customers over the finish line. I'd say it's stability and quality of product, price point of that product, ability to deliver that product. And then last is sustainability, at least in the high volume markets. That's really what we're seeing right now.
When you're selling to consumers, sustainability is a little bit more of a marketing thing.
But even then, a consumer is not going to buy something that's 20% more. It's just impossible in today's, especially in today's world.
If you can save someone money or make them more money, that's ultimately...
That's all that matters.
All that matters,
like,
yeah.
It's honestly all that matters. And the chemicals industry is... That's why like... One of the things like on a long-term basis, when we look at what can we do, like right now we're building our own assets and selling the product. If you really look at what we're doing is we're changing the whole entire cost structure of this industry. Eventually, this is going to be really valuable to other chemical companies, right? So like, it's not just us going out and building it. What if we can license a view of this or a version of this to other chemical companies? So our impact actually scales much faster. We're not there yet. I'd say like, we'll get there maybe in the next 2 plants, 3 plants, something like that. But I'd say ultimately that's where a lot of value can be derived.
What does the long term look like?
What I can say is we break down the company into phases. Phase one of the company was demonstrate that the technology works and demonstrate you have customers for those products. We did phase one, check. Phase two is, okay, now that you've shown that you can build this stuff and sell it, go do that as many times as you can. Go build and sell and make as much money as possible. So that's where we are today, phase two. Phase three is now let's do it with a bunch of different products, not just the products that we know we can make. Let's do it with a whole suite of different products that we can go after. And then phase four is how do we start integrating all of this so we can give license packages to other customers so they can build their own chemical assets. So instead of us being the builders, how do we let customers or partners become the owners of their own chemical assets? And so that's kind of the progression of how we see the chemicals business. Eventually, I do want to be able to say like, hey, we're making products, like actual like molds for cars or insulations for homes and things like that. But today we're focused on the chemistry.
In that stage four, you can really envision pursuing even deeper levels of vertical integration. Like right now it's the manufacturing plant, it's supply chain distribution. But in phase four, like the chemicals industry underpins everything. You can vertically integrate to the point that you're not even really a chemicals industry. You're actually just decarbonizing the physical world.
And that's where we want to go. And a lot of companies claim to want to do that. And the only way to do that is to decarbonize chemicals. So that's where we want to play first.
Are you licensing out the patents on how to build the machines or do you sell the machinery?
I like to use a car analogy. Like imagine if I came to you with like, hey, I have the blueprints for the world's greatest car. Your first question would be like, let me test drive the car. And I'd be like, no, I only have the blueprints. You can't test drive the car, right? You'd be like, go away, right? So like our business model is very much focused on build, own, and operate first and building those core capabilities. At a certain point, if you think about like different markets where it would take us a lot to build core competencies, you really want to have partners. And what Solugen at that point is providing technology packages. And then it's through this network of partners that you can then kind of enter stage four and start to really not just decarbonize chemicals, but all the things downstream of chemicals as well.
Yeah, it becomes like an Intel inside type play at that point.
How do you evolve from being a PhD to running a nine-figure revenue business. What advice do you have for other people trying to do that?
Get a coach.
All right, that settles it.
You know, it's funny. I think there's this, the best business advice I got was actually from Mary Curie. I didn't get it from her, but it's a quote from her about how this concept of fear is just needs to be flipped on its head to curiosity. And I think once you have this concept of PhDs are trained to be curious, that's what we were trained to do. But if you apply it in the context of business, get really interested in the business that you're running to a point where you're just curious about every piece of it. I think that's how you can actually build a business that withstands time. It's just pure curiosity from some founders.
The second thing I would add here is have an amazing co-founder. So the co-founder relationship is one of those critical ingredients to get you to essentially never stop growing as individuals, as a team.
How'd you guys know
that we were good co-founders?
Yeah. Like anything specifically you were thinking through or would encourage, maybe you got lucky, but like would encourage other people to think about?
I mean, it's complementary skill sets, but I think it's more of having a really, really strong personal foundation, friendship, respect.
Yeah, see, I feel like you should be at a point where you feel comfortable enough. This is going to sound weird, but comfortable enough crying in front of your co-founder about something, and you know that like they're going to have your back. It sounds sentimental and soft, but I think that's like the ultimate kind of test. Is like, can you be vulnerable with this person?
Yeah. And what's the other analogy, of Gorb? Is this the kind of person that's going to bail me out of jail in Tijuana?
Oh yeah, I have this very simple proxy when I hire people. Which is this the kind of person that's going to help me get out of a jail in Tijuana, or are they going to prevent me from getting into a jail in Tijuana? And so like at the time the company needed both of us to be able to kind of do both for each other.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. This is a lot of fun.
Thanks for letting us ramble. Hey. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, a lot of fun.
And thank you for listening. A quick call out. According to YouTube, over 87% of people who are tuning in are not actually subscribed. If you like this episode, make sure to like, subscribe, and comment on YouTube. Follow and leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts. Like and retweet on Twitter. And reach out if you're building a cool startup. Thanks again to Gaurav and Sean for coming on, SecureFrame for supporting the show, and to you for tuning in. See you next time.